Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Right in the middle of audio open lines and right in the middle of a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly report on the Shia and the Sunni conflict. Now, it's focusing on Iraq, but of course this isn't a conflict that only extends to Iraq. As we've seen already from the report, it has a lot to do with what happened in Iran after the fall of the Shah. We're going now back 30-plus years. Well, yeah, 30 years. It also has to do with what's going on in Saudi Arabia. It has to do with going on in the whole region. And the question I'm asking, we heard a previous report from a Nightline quiz on what our lawmakers, in particular those who serve and will serve on the House Armed Forces Committee, know about Islam. What they discovered, if you didn't hear that, was the key figures, both outgoing and incoming, didn't know the difference between Shias and Sunnis. They didn't know why they're at each other's throats. Does this surprise you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's hear from you. Issuesetc@kfuo.org is our email address. Back to this report from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the Shia-Sunni conflict.
It was war in Lebanon in the early 1980s that marked the beginning of the use of suicide bombers as a method of war. Hezbollah suicide bombers killed almost 600 Israeli soldiers, which eventually led to their pullout in southern Lebanon. They also bombed the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut and killed 241.
At that time, everybody thought that martyrdom is the monopoly of Shias, that the Sunnis would never do it. But gradually, Arab sort of radical Sunni groups, Palestinians, as well as Al-Qaeda, came to theological shift to embrace what they had seen in Hezbollah and make it their own. We saw that they actually adopted the things the Shiites, at the very time that the Shiites stopped using it.
Now, this is very interesting. I'm going to reread what he said there because this is key. Key to understanding suicide bombing. Nasser said that martyrdom was a monopoly of the Shiite sect of Islam. They were theologically predisposed toward martyrdom in the name of their religion. And many people at the time thought that the Sunnis, the other sect of Islam, would never practice martyrdom or suicide bombing. But he says, gradually, an Arab sort of radical Sunni groups, Palestinians as well as Al-Qaeda, came to a theological shift to embrace what they had seen in Hezbollah and make it their own. We saw that they actually adopted the things the Shiites do at the very time that the Shiites stopped doing it. So can we explain why Sunnis, who no one thought would become martyrs through suicide bombing, became martyrs through suicide bombing? That was supposed to be a Shiite thing. But if you don't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite, you can't even ask that question.
Nasser says the Shiites' reluctance to turn to violence in Iraq was greatly influenced by the revered Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani.
He very early on understood that this is a historical opportunity for Shiites to assume control of Iraq. And elections, democracy, one man, one vote benefits them. And they should not embrace violence. They should embrace the political process. But as the Sunni violence against the Shiites escalated, as Shiites died in marketplaces and were assassinated, he began to lose authority. So, you know, the Shiites began to assassinate, torture, kill, kidnap, and attack Sunnis as well. And Sistani continues to call for calm. But his voice is fainter than it was 2 years ago.
The leader, his voice is growing louder as a young firebrand, Qadr al-Sadr, not highly regarded as a religious leader, but he has a strong militia and close ties to the government.
He was never a good seminary student, never finished his work, used to play a lot of video games when he was a youth. But in some ways, he has surprised a lot of people because not only has he survived, he has gained in power and he's proven himself to be politically savvy.
Nasser says one of the most significant and unintended results of the invasion of Iraq was the empowering of neighboring Shiite Iran, leaders who use a Shiite belief in messianism for their own political gain.
Now, here is where you want to listen most carefully as we come to the end of this PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly report on the Shia-Sunni conflict. They're about to talk about he calls it messianism, but the apocalyptic vision of the leader of Iran. We know the president of Iran, he's been on the news so much lately, has an idea about the end of the world, and he believes it's imminent, or at least he's hinted so strongly for the last year or so that he believes it is imminent. He believes it also come with the downfall of the nation state of Israel. And that's what makes all the headlines. When he says Israel will go the way of the Soviet Union, he's talking about his apocalyptic vision of the end of the world and the return of the 12th Imam. You say, what in the world is that? Well, it's a particular Shiite belief. The Sunnis don't believe it, but the Shiites do. And again, if you're a lawmaker and you want to understand what makes the president of Iran tick, you don't understand the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni, and you don't know if he's a Shiite or a Sunni? And if he has connections to, if you assume, as one of the people in the ABC Nightline quiz on Islam did, that Osama bin Laden must be a Shiite, because aren't the Shiites the bad guys? No, he's a Sunni. If you assume things like that, you will not understand who's with who and who's against who, or why in the world Iran may be even more dangerous than I guess most of our lawmakers think.
There's the expectation of a second coming of the 12th Imam. And therefore, the Iranian regime under Ayatollah Khomeini, and even it is doing it today under the President Ahmadinejad, uses this popular level, folk level attachment to the myth of second coming in order to mobilize the population for various political or military activities.
Here's a good analogy, and then we'll finish this thing up. Let's say for the sake of argument that not this president, but a president of the United States completely bought the Left Behind series theology. He was a dyed-in-the-wool, premillennial dispensationalist. He believed that with 1944 and 1948 and the establishment of the modern nation state of Israel, the end times timetable has started again. The clock is ticking, and we're less than a decade away from the end of the world. He believes that the support of the nation state of Israel for the final battle of Armageddon is the highest priority of any government. Let's just say, by the way, at this particular moment, pause in prayer and thank God that the president today is apparently not a premillennial dispensationalist. Maybe he is. He must not be much of one because he doesn't talk like this. But let's say that the president was, not this president, but any president. Would it be wise for, say, our allies or our enemies to understand the particular theology of the American president on this subject? If he starts nosing around in the Middle East, what he's up to, why he's doing it, why he thinks Israel is so important, if a U.S. president were a premillennial dispensationalist, a Christian who holds to a very strange apocalyptic view of the end of the world, you bet they would. Our allies, it might even determine who our allies and our enemies turn out to be. Theology does matter. And if the president of Iran has a strange apocalyptic view informed by his Shiite theology that involves the destruction of the nation state of Israel, the coming of a 12th Imam, and a battle of Armageddon, and he might be developing atomic weapons on the side, we probably should school ourselves in his theology to understand what will most certainly prove to be an enemy.
Military activities, Nasser says, such as the most recent war with Israel and Lebanon, or the greatly increased stature of the Iranian-funded Hezbollah, at the same time bolstering the influence of Iran as a major player in the Middle East, a state of affairs that causes considerable angst amongst Sunnis in the region, who fear that Iran is building a nuclear bomb.
The lesson of Hezbollah's showing in Lebanon is to also show that the Shias have the ability to be a regional power. They're the ones who have the, you know, the capability or courage to take on the Israelis, not the Sunnis. It doesn't heard this attitude in the Arab world that Iran also happens to be the most powerful country in the region right now.
Thatcher thinks the sectarian violence is moving toward an all-out civil war.
There is not sufficient force on the ground to forcibly separate them out and impose peace on them by force. The scale of killings, the ways in which communities are being cleansed on both sides is all suggestive that you're having, essentially both sides are posturing for what might be a final showdown.
What is needed, he contends, more than anything is diplomacy. For the U.S. to talk to countries it now has no diplomatic ties with, namely Iran and Syria.
Now, engaging Iran or Syria does not mean recognizing them, does not mean accepting their regimes. It means, rather, that you open a door to be able to talk about some basic concerns of the U.S. It's like the way we dealt with the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan could call the Soviet Union an evil empire and yet meet with Mikhail Gorbachev and try to push for U.S.'s interests.
Everyone in the Bush administration agrees with Professor Nasser's views, but he was invited to meet with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the President. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Washington.
All right, I want to know what you think about this. The two things put together, the Nightline ABC News quiz of our lawmakers, discovering that many who serve on the House Arms Committee, both those outgoing and incoming, do not know even, say, the basic distinction between a Shia and a Sunni, and the PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly report that we just heard on how important that distinction is in Islam and how important it is for us, especially our lawmakers, to understand that distinction. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. One more analogy, then we're going to talk about a change, a much controverted change in the law in Pakistan, another Muslim country. And again, it has to do with their theology as much as it has to do with their politics. During the Cold War, from the end of World War II until roughly 1990, if a politician in the U.S. would have stood up and said, you know, I don't know much about communism, but I'd like to serve on the House Armed Services Committee, you'd say, maybe you should either change your position or learn a little something about communism. Or if he said, oh, I know the communists. Are they Christians? What are they? Didn't know the religious beliefs of communism as a political philosophy. That it is, in fact, at its very core, an atheistic religious, political and religious philosophy. If a lawmaker said, would admit to the fact that he didn't know that communism was atheistic, do you think he'd be qualified to serve on a committee on the armed forces, especially at a time of war? It's not just a question of religion. It's a question of fundamentally understanding someone else's worldview, especially your enemy's worldview. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, Islamicists in Pakistan are unhappy, and in this case, it's with a new rape law in their country. Here's the story from Reuters.
Many women in Pakistan won't be impressed with this largely male gathering. It's being held in protest at new laws designed to protect women. The Women Protection Bill was signed last month. It takes the crime of rape out of the sphere of religious laws known as the Hudud Ordinances. 10,000 supporters of Islamist parties gathered to show their fury at the changes.
The people of this country have a keen sense of honour. They will never allow a law opposed to Islam, Quran and Islamic civil law. We will not accept a government, any measures or any bill opposed to it.
The law reduces the burden of proof on rape victims by allowing them to seek justice without the need for four male witnesses. Its introduction is being seen as a key test for President Pervez Musharraf's philosophy of enlightened moderation. The protest took place a day after he ruled out any changes to the new regulations. The issue highlights a long struggle between reformers and religious conservatives over the direction of Pakistani society. Women's groups want a total repeal of the Islamic laws, which still ban sex outside marriage and allow women to be stoned to death for adultery. But there's clearly widespread opposition to such views. Pakistan is balancing on a difficult tightrope. Sonia Legg, Reuters.
Now, if you had trouble sorting that out, let me just do it for you as briefly as possible. In Pakistan, the new government is trying to pass a law that if a woman is raped, she doesn't have to have four male witnesses to prove that she was raped. You say, why would they want to pass such a law? Well, because under Sharia law, that is Islamic civil law, practiced in Pakistan alongside the regular laws, for a woman to prove that she was raped, she has to have four male eyewitnesses of the act. Seems a little stacked against her, doesn't it? You could have a rape kit done in the hospital that would prove that she was raped. You could have the DNA of the rapist. You can have one male eyewitness of the rape. You could have two. You could have three. And you still couldn't prove that she was raped under Sharia law. It's a pretty nasty law, isn't it? So just put it in these terms for those of you who would like to drive it home a little bit more. Let's say your daughter was raped under Sharia law. And there weren't four men standing around watching while it happened. You could not convict the rapist under Sharia law. And all that the Pakistani government is trying to do is reduce the burden of proof on the woman who accuses a man of rape to the level that it is enjoyed by people like here in the West. And who's upset about it? Islamic men. And one man there said they would not accept a government, a law, or anything that would compromise Sharia law. You think it might be important to understand what Muslims believe? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Audio Open Lines, Issues, Etc. This Wednesday, the 13th of December, our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And up next is Dennis calling from his car. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, Pastor Todd, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to address the issue of Twelver Islam, because I've spoken about that before on your show. Twelver Islam, their apocalyptic stance is really nothing new. I mean, this has been going on for centuries within Islam, particularly, in Iran. You know, the 79 overthrow of the Shah of Iran was an actual event that was tied to 12 of Shia Islam. A lot of the Shia Muslims considered Khomeini as the father of the Imam. They thought that he may be the hidden Imam or the promised one. It's also interesting to note that prior to the overthrow of the Shah, they did have nuclear energy. They had nuclear power plants in Iran that were actually helped. The construction was helped by the United States. Also going back to another apocalyptic approach, the Sunnis, they also have their apocalyptic, paradigm or their story that they're anticipating.
Very briefly, Dennis, what is the Sunnis? We know what the Shiites is so far, but what's the Sunnis' apocalyptic view?
Well, the Sunnis believe that there's going to be a promised Imam is going to appear, and then Isa, who is Jesus, and this is going to occur in Damascus, and this is going to be the start and the onset of this worldwide conflagration against the infidels, and all the Muslims are going to rise up, and they're basically going to wipe out all the unbelievers on the planet.
Dennis, thank you very much. I appreciate you listening, and I appreciate you bringing some of your expertise to the conversation here. So it does make a difference just because someone isn't a Shiite, or someone like the president of Iran who believes in the 12th Imam coming and the destruction of Israel and whatnot. Even if he were a Sunni, it would be important to understand it, because the Sunnis would believe in the rise of a final Imam, the return of Jesus, oddly enough, and then the final world war between Islam and everyone else. Again, I ask the question, do you think it's important that we understand in this day and age a little bit more about Islam, and maybe that our lawmakers understand a little bit some little bit more than they apparently do about Islam. Or let me put it to you this way. I know it's 2 years out and you're not even ready to think about who you might vote for to be president of the United States. I think it's safe to say that all of this isn't going to be over in 2008. With the election of any new president, it's not going to be suddenly like Islam goes back into the corner and terrorism goes away. It'll still be here. So you think it's important that the next president of the United States know a little something about Islam. Do you think it will be a subject of presidential debates? What do you know about Islam? It should be. I can see Jim Lehrer asking the question, and I could see both candidates saying, well, Islam is peace. It's a religion of peace, isn't it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our Issues Etc. book of the month is called From Heaven Above. Now, if those words sound familiar, there's a reason. They're the opening words of a carol, a Christmas carol written by Martin Luther in the very early part of the 16th century, based upon Luke chapter 2, the account of Jesus' birth and the angel's announcement of Jesus' birth. From heaven above to earth I come. It's the text and it's the basis for our Issues Etc. book of the month for December, called From Heaven Above. It's a picture book for kids, age 5 to 9. That's a good range there. To find out more, just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the book on our homepage, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for December, called From Heaven Above, A Christmas Carol by Martin Luther. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Wayne Grudem will join us on evangelical feminism, and Dr. James Nestegen on the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America's report on human sexuality. And we're also going to be discussing this week's Newsweek magazine cover story on the birth of Christ and family values with Dr. Peter Scare. The birth of Christ and family values. The nexus of two things. Did Jesus, for unto you is born this day in the city of David, a teacher of family values, who is Christ the Lord. And you will call his name Jesus, because he will teach us all family values. No, I don't think that either Luke or Matthew read that way. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Darren Storkson. He's Regional Director for Southeast Asia for LCMS World Relief, about the relief efforts going on in Indonesia in the aftermath of last May's earthquake, and of course, the destruction that is still lingering from the tsunamis in that area. We'll find out from him also, what's it like to be a Christian in what is the most Muslim part of the world? More Muslims live in that region than in the Middle East. That's coming up after this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc.org. In the last half hour of the program, Bill O'Reilly, a very difficult interview with a victim of abortion.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
During this month of December, Peace Lutheran Church in South County again conducted its annual German Christmas service. AM 850 KFUO recorded the service and will air that recording on Saturday, December 16th, 4 in the afternoon. It's an annual tradition both at Peace Lutheran Church and on AM 850 KFUO. German Christmas worship this Saturday afternoon at 4 on AM 850 KFUO, Inspirational Christmas Radio for St. Louis. Fröhliche Weihnachten.
We give thanks for the folks at LCMS World Relief, because they are the hands and the feet that allow many people to reach out in charity and love to those who are less fortunate than we.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Arthur Just on the importance of LCMS World Relief.
In the Gospels, Jesus says that he came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And spending out his life for us on the cross is how he served us. Because Christ is in us, and we embody him in his mercy and love, we are to manifest that in our lives. And LCMS World Relief does exactly that. by reaching out with concrete expressions of Christ's love, mercy, and compassion to those who have been broken by storm and tempest, who, for whatever reason, need the kind of love and compassion that is in us because Christ is in us.
For more information or to donate to LCMS World Relief, call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438.
Martin Luther is the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December. It's titled From Heaven Above. It's the perfect Christmas gift for your young child or grandchild. From Heaven Above is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. From Heaven Above by Martin Luther, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The United Nations is expecting a decision today on a significant document that has the plight of the disabled in mind. But as the votes pour in, pro-life groups are concerned certain language in the treaty is too vague and could open the door for abortion on demand and euthanasia for the disabled. Josh Montez explains.
The International Treaty for the Disabled has good intentions for people around the world, but Peter Smith with the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children says terms like sexual and reproductive health are too broad.
And if you've got vague, undefined stuff, especially like sexual and reproductive health, well, what does it mean? And some activist judge somewhere might say, oh, well, that means there's a right to abortion.
Thomas Jacobson, with Focus on the Family Action, worries that other language could be interpreted as a call to euthanize the disabled.
The major risk with this document is that it can be used for precisely the opposite purpose of what it was designed to do.
Smith says countries that sign the treaty should do so with reservations.
Pray that 40 countries would put in interpretive statements or reservations saying that sexual and reproductive health does not include a right to abortion, and there are no new human rights created by this convention.
He says if 40 nations say sexual and reproductive health does not include a right to abortion, it means there's no agreement on that term, and that will protect countries from pressure to legalize abortion. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
Smith's group was key to getting the UN to adopt language in the treaty so that people in situations like Terry Schiavo would not be denied food, liquids, or life-saving medical treatment. If the General Assembly votes in favor of the document, it will be presented by the UN for ratification in 2007. Countries that sign on to the document adopt the treaty as their national law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Wednesday, December 13th, 2006, Cornelia Lindwedel. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in loving memory of her husband, Lauren, and their daughter, Diane, who have gone to meet our Heavenly Father. Once again, a very special thank you to today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsor, Cornelia Lindwedel of St. Louis.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In the last hour here, we'll spend the first half of it with Darren Storkson, Regional Director of South for Southeast Asia for LCMS World Relief, talking about the earthquake that hit Indonesia last May and the relief efforts that have been afoot ever since. And then in the last half hour of the program, we've got audio open lines. I will warn you in advance, if you're planning on listening to the last half hour and you got kids who might be listening or overhearing the program, we're going to play an interview between Bill O'Reilly and a victim of one of the Kansas abortions, this abortionist that Bill O'Reilly has been talking about so much. We're going to play an interview between Bill O'Reilly and this young woman, and it is graphic, and it's disturbing. So be warned, and I'll mention this again before we go into that audio a half hour from now on Issues Etc. Darren Storkson is Regional Director of Southeast Asia for LCMS World Relief. Darren, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
What's it like being a Christian in the largest, in the world's largest Muslim country with the largest Muslim population?
Well, it's actually probably not as bad as you might think. These things always tend to sound a lot worse than they are. For the most part, life continues normally for all of us. Churches are plentiful in most areas, and people can attend church unmolested. But within the last 5 years, there has been an increasing trend of anti-Christian violence. Their churches have been bombed from time to time. They have been shut down from time to time. People have been stopped from worshiping. They've been evicted. These kinds of acts are perpetrated by radical Muslims, which constitute just a tiny fraction of the population there, but nevertheless they can act sometimes with impunity against the law. And so that's obviously a source of stress for Christians and a source of persecution.
You live in Indonesia most of the time. You're only here in the States just visiting. Last May, there was an earthquake. What was your experience of it? Did you feel any of its effects?
No, the earthquake was centered in the city of Yogyakarta, which is in central Java. We're based in Jakarta, the capital, which is in the western part of Java. It's too far away to have been affected.
Mm-hmm.
But the earthquake was quite devastating, even though it didn't garner nearly as much media attention as the devastating Indian Ocean tsunami. And it didn't kill, of course, nearly as many people. But it actually destroyed more homes than the tsunami did. Most people don't realize that. More families were displaced by that central Java earthquake than in the Indian Ocean tsunami.
And am I right in assuming that that's on top of course, the devastation that has yet to be completely remedied from the tsunami?
That's right. These are two completely separate areas of the country. Indonesia is a very large country, consists of islands. And the tsunami affected a certain set of islands in one extreme end of the country, whereas the earthquake hit in central Java, which is more in the center of the country.
Can you give us an idea about, I know this must be varied, but can you give us an idea about the nature of the civilization over there, what the cities are like, the kind of the level of civilization, so that when we picture, I think most people pictured, well, you got Indonesia on the other side of the world, here came a tsunami, here came an earthquake. When they picture homes destroyed, what are we talking about?
Well, we have to first maybe draw a distinction between urban life and rural life. In Indonesia, you have some very large cities. The capital city of Jakarta is around 15 million people. And these cities are relatively modern and metropolitan in the sense that they have all sorts of modern facilities, hotels, restaurants, and the like, and lots of international standard housing. But the vast majority of the population still live in rural areas. And in those areas, the population tends to be quite poor. So they're living in rudimentary housing. In the case of central Java or Yogyakarta, where that earthquake struck, you have peasant farmers, subsistence farmers, living in homes that are built of brick and cinder block. And so it's easy to understand why they collapsed so readily in a major earthquake like that.
What about the government there? What kind of aid were they able to extend to the victims of the earthquake in May?
The government has its own resource challenges, so it is not generally able to provide a tremendous amount of direct relief in these situations. At the most, it can usually provide some coordination between agencies and so forth, but not a great deal of direct emergency relief. Now, the government has promised, both in the case of the tsunami and in the case of the more recent earthquake, that it will provide either new homes for the victims or funds for them to rebuild themselves. But this has become a source of contention in the country because these promises are very long in the fulfillment, and the people become impatient and waiting for these promises to be realized.
How welcome on the part of the government are the relief efforts of LCMS World Relief, both after the tsunami and then the more recent earthquake in May?
Relief efforts are always welcome. That's never a problem in Indonesia or elsewhere. Relief efforts are always most welcome.
Any obstacles or basic obstacles to doing relief work there?
One challenge as a faith-based organization, of course, working in non-Christian areas, is sometimes just getting accepted. For example, in the earthquake area, the villages that we have targeted for our aid are 100% Muslim villages. And initially, when we approached these villages, they didn't want to have anything to do with a Christian relief agency. And they basically said that they didn't want to accept our aid. So it took some effort to build those relationships and reassure them to get to the point where they were happy to accept our aid. And then over the last few months, we've been able to develop those relationships further to the point that they're now quite comfortable to have a Christian relief agency working among them. And we hope that relationship will continue, perhaps for years into the future.
Why were they hesitant, these Muslim villages, at first, to receive aid from a Christian relief organization?
I think that they're generally suspicious of the motives of Christian relief agencies. Of course, we cannot paint all Christian relief agencies with the same brush, and different agencies do use different modalities. But they're suspicious of the motives, that an agency is really coming in not to help them, but simply to preach to them, or simply to proselytize them, and not to help. And they're suspicious of that when it comes to Christian agencies. So we need to reassure them that, in fact, we do care, and that we are there to help them.
How do you do that? That's, I guess, the $6 million question. How do you, without compromising the message that you do want to have opportunity to bring, if the opportunity presents itself, of the gospel of Jesus Christ, how do you thread the needle there and convince the Muslim village, you know, we're here to help you. We're going to remain unapologetically Christian in the way we help you and what we say, but we're here to help you.
I don't know that there's any specific formula to do that. Initially, when you have the case of a specific rejection like we did in Yogyakarta, we have to obviously talk first and build the relationship with the community leaders. These communities are very traditional. They always have traditional leaders. And so if you build a relationship with the community leader, then the community will follow what the leader decides. So initially it involves sitting down, having talks, reassuring, introducing yourself, describing your organization, and these kinds of things. And then that gets you in the door. But then after that, of course, the real proof is in the pudding, or in the actual work that we do in the village. If we were to come in and conduct activities that were perceived as offensive, then of course we would be made unwelcome very quickly. But when in fact we do show care and concern, and we do in fact follow through on our promises and help the people with their needs, then we build those relationships very quickly.
Tell us about the scope of the damage, its magnitude in the villages where LCMS World Relief was doing its work in Indonesia.
What we try to do, because we're not a terribly large relief agency, of course, compared to major international relief agencies that have significantly larger budgets, we have to find target our limited resources in ways that we can leverage to best effect. And, of course, that's based on need, of course, of the people that we're trying to help, and also where we can perhaps build relationships in the best way, and in conjunction with perhaps a local church partner. So in this case, we were able to identify a handful of villages that had been neglected because of their location perhaps being a bit more remote and so forth. They were neglected by other aid agencies. So no one else was attending to these villages. So it was we were able to then come in and target these specific villages and in a way adopt them as villages that we're going to help. Again, hopefully, for years into the future.
So they may not have been helped, or they may have had to wait an awful long time for any help, given their location.
If we hadn't been there, they, as far as I know, they might not have received anything yet. But we were, in fact, able to be there very quickly.
What kind of stuff did you do?
Well, initially, it was the distribution of some emergency relief goods, like dry food items, tarpaulins for people to construct temporary shelters and things of that nature. And we have since transitioned into reconstruction, and we have provided the families in these targeted villages with building materials so that they could rebuild their own homes themselves. Things like corrugated fiber for roofing, bamboo and wood for construction. And we didn't need to provide bricks because there's plenty of bricks on the ground that they can collect from the rubble. And so we simply provided these kinds of building materials, and now the families are engaged and taking ownership and responsibility by rebuilding their homes themselves.
What kind of help did you get from indigenous Christians there in Indonesia?
We partner with local Lutheran partners, which is always a priority for us. So there's two local Lutheran church bodies that we were able to partner with in this situation. And they continue to be important partners because we don't want to deploy large numbers of foreign staff people to run the show and so forth, but rather we want to empower our local partners to do the work and build the relationships, because at the end of the day, they're going to be the ones that are still living there as neighbors and have the possibility to follow up on those relationships that have been built.
I was talking with one of your colleagues yesterday, and she mentioned that she mentioned something about non-governmental organization status to do work in other countries, LCMS World Relief. And I said, well, how do you get that? I mean, who tells you who classifies you as a non-governmental organization? Because these are the classification organizations that are out in the world everywhere. They seem to have really open access to places that governmental organizations couldn't go.
Well, I think that the non-governmental organization designation is not a specific one, but generally any organization that is engaged in these kinds of humanitarian relief activities will be considered a non-governmental organization. The specific laws and procedures can vary substantially from country to country. But in general, countries, of course, are quite open to receiving aid, and that's generally not a problem. Even for a faith-based organization in a Muslim country like Indonesia.
So where does the relief effort, and I guess I'm thinking in terms of kind of the reconstruction, where does it stand on both the tsunami damage and the earthquake damage, those two different regions, those two different disasters that have so recently struck?
Well, it depends who you ask. There's been a lot of media coverage of the slow pace of reconstruction in the wake of the tsunami because, of course, the people that have suffered such tremendous losses and have been living in camps now for a couple of years would much rather be in homes. So naturally they are distressed and in many cases depressed and complaining about the fact that they don't have homes even now 2 years after the date. But the reality is that in spite of the tremendous resources that were poured out to all organizations and governments in the wake of that tsunami, that was just a disaster of unprecedented scale. So no one was in place with the kind of capacity to really respond in a way, in an efficient way. And then, of course, you have the challenge of locally available resources. The amount of wood, for example, that would be required to rebuild all of these homes just for the tsunami exceeds the amount of wood that would normally be produced by the country, the entire country, in an entire year. So that becomes, again, this the scale of this disaster was so huge that it just overwhelmed the capacity of relief organizations, of the natural resources in the locations, and so forth. So It's just been very difficult for these organizations, in spite of the monetary resources available, to rebuild as quickly as they would like to. And there's also been all kinds of challenges with respect to engineering and construction and corruption. Let's face it, in many of these countries, Indonesia is well known as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And so when you show up with in the wake of a disaster like this with a lot of money, unfortunately, there are unscrupulous business people and contractors that just see it as an opportunity to make a windfall profit. And that has happened in a lot of these reconstruction projects. So for all of these reasons, organizations have not been able to complete all of the houses, even though it's been 2 years. So it's going to be probably another 2 or 3 years, I would guess. I have no way of predicting it with any certainty, but before the entire number of houses would be completed.
Two final questions for you. The tsunami, of course, was instant and worldwide news. It was one of those once-in-a-decade news stories that virtually everyone who was watching a television any time during those 3 or 4 weeks after the tsunamis knew that something big had happened. This earthquake in May, not so much, at least here in the United States. Do you have a bit of a task ahead of you to raise awareness of this second disaster in Indonesia and the need that it has occasioned?
We definitely do, and that's one of the unfortunate things about the way relief work works. Generally, donations tend to follow news coverage. So when news coverage of an event is very high, donations follow. But when news coverage is lower, donations do not. So as you've noted, the news coverage exposure for the earthquake was just a fraction of what there was for the tsunami, despite the fact that more people are displaced by it. And as a result, the donations that we and other organizations receive for that, but also just a fraction of what was received for the tsunami. So that's certainly a challenge when you have disasters that, for whatever reason, do not get the amount of news coverage that they perhaps warrant from a certain perspective, that we don't then receive the kind of donations that we would like to receive.
Finally then, Darren, I would like you to tell us the story of this young Muslim boy there in Indonesia who I hear has begun Christian catechesis.
Oh, that's incredible. And it's just one of the incredible blessings and privileges of being able to work in a place like that is to see, of course, the Spirit of God working among people that normally, in fact, are very resistant, whether they're Muslims or Hindus, but are very resistant to the whole topic of Christianity and show no interest generally. But it's been wonderful to see that happen, and just through faithfulness to God's word and through exposure to the gospel in church, and see how that works change in people's lives. And so this is a case of a Muslim orphan who is being sponsored for school, and he's attending a Christian school. And, of course, I take him to church with me, when I'm in town anyway, take him to church with me. And, of course, never any pressure on him that this is not something that he has to be coerced or compelled into. But he has just been showing an increasingly strong interest. And one of the most remarkable events just took place recently when I found a copy of the recent Luther movie. I don't know how recent actually it is here in the States, but over there it's pretty recent. The Luther movie in a DVD store, and I thought that some of the young people might get a kick out of seeing that. I'm thinking particularly about the Christians. But this young Muslim boy was included in that group and sat and watched the movie with us. And the next day, when after school, he asks me if he can borrow the movie. And so I ask why. Well, he goes to a Franciscan school, and it turns out that he was sharing with the Franciscan friars at the school about Martin Luther. And they wanted to see the movie as a result of what he told them. So we sat along the movie with him, along with a couple of local language versions of Luther's Small Catechism with him to the Franciscan school. So the Franciscans are learning about Martin Luther from the Muslim boy.
Very interesting, very interesting. Darren Storkson is Regional Director for Southeast Asia for LCMS World Relief. Darren, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, LCMS World Relief is working there. You just heard about it in Indonesia. You might not have even heard about that May earthquake. Now you have, and the need is there. The need will continue, as Darren pointed out, probably given the two disasters, the tsunami on the one side and the earthquake on the other, 4 years. We need mention only also the ongoing need here in the United States in the southern part of the country. Again, 4 years the need will go on, the victims of a hurricane in this country and elsewhere. To find out more about everything LCMS World Relief is doing worldwide and here at home, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You will find the logo for LCMS World Relief right there at our homepage. You can also call them toll-free. They have a toll-free number, and you can earmark a donation for any of the things you find out about on our website or any of the things you've heard about here today as we've talked with Darren Storkson, 1-888-930-4438. It's the end of the year, and that means you're going to be given an opportunity to consider a lot of relief organizations at the end of the year. Seriously consider LCMS World Relief, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. When we come back from this break, or do we have time to get to Bill O'Reilly? And let's get it started, okay? This is difficult. So if you've got kids sitting in the car, if someone's kids are listening in, this interview that Bill's going to have with a young woman who received an abortion from a very famous abortion doctor in Kansas, George Tiller. He's a late-term abortion clinic doctor in Kansas. The story she tells about this abortion she had at age 14 is difficult to listen to, and if you're a parent with the child listening in, you might just want to turn it down or find something else to talk about. Bill O'Reilly had the opportunity to interview her, and again, this is disturbing, but I think it needs to be heard. It comes from Bill O'Reilly's program on Fox News. We'll start it, have to stop it here at the bottom or the top of the hour, and pick it up for audio open lines on the other side.
In fact, a follow-up segment tonight, authorities in Kansas still investigating late-term abortionist Dr. George Tiller to see if he has violated state law about reporting the rapes of underage girls. Tiller will abort babies at any time up until birth, sometimes citing the depression of the mother as a medical reason. Joining us now from Washington is Kelly. Got pregnant at age 13 in Maryland and had her fetus aborted by Tiller. Okay, so you were 20 weeks pregnant. Yes. When you brought the situation to your parents' attention, I understand. State of Maryland, you could not have an abortion that late. But your father and mother, I guess, decided to take you to Kansas, where Tiller advertises on the net. Everybody knows who he is. He'll abort babies at any time. So your parents take you there. You go into the clinic, pick it up from there.
Well, it was a five-day process. And when I first went in, they have counseling that they offer. It's a group counseling with other women that are going through the same thing. And during the 5 days, they insert expandable whatever into the cervix to slowly dilate you through the five-day process. And about the third or fourth day, Dr. Tiller came in and injected into the amniotic sac saline solution, which suffocated and burned my baby to death. And on the last day, they put you in a room with other women. There's like maybe 6 to 10 beds in a big room, and every woman is lying there. And they kind of go down the line, and whoever's ready, you know, they decide that you're dilated enough, and they put you in a wheelchair and wheel you out to another room. And in this other room, there's basically a toilet, and they told me to sit on the toilet, lean on the nurse, and push my baby into a toilet.
All right, we're going to take up that interview between Bill O'Reilly and this young lady, Kelly, who was, I'm going to say quite boldly, plainly, one of the victims of George Tiller in Kansas, who is a late-term abortion doctor. He runs a clinic there and apparently has people from all over the country who avail themselves of his gruesome service. We'll hear more from her. That's the gruesome end, the first gruesome end of her experience with Tiller. After this, Bill O'Reilly will begin to ask her about the aftermath of the abortion. I want you to listen carefully. This is a very young woman, and she had this abortion from George Tiller in Kansas when she was 14. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issues@kfuo.org. Audio open lines for the last half hour of the program. We've already got it started. We'll finish up that interview with Bill O'Reilly after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.